Warning, the following podcast may contain adult language, biased opinions, or irritating fanboy rants. Akihabara renditions will not be held responsible for people under the age of 18 or who are thin-skinned and easily offended. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guest respectively.
Back to Akihabara Renditions, coming to you live from an undisclosed location on a barge floating out in the ocean, somewhere in international waters.
International waters was the only way we could get this done, wasn't it?
I mean, I'm sure there are some, like, in a puppet regimes where, like, there are no laws and, I don't know, you can buy some airtime along with, you know, children, if you wanted to.
I have a feeling that's where we're sailing, isn't it?
Sailing. Bless. Somebody's in charge of this vessel.
All right. So, floating aimlessly in our undisclosed barge.
Yeah, that's pretty fair.
All right. Well, so we are Akihabara Renditions. My name is Drew. I'm joined by Richard.
Hey.
So, we've been off for a little bit. Kind of just schedules couldn't align, but we're back now. Ready to start episode 4. Of Caesar series 2 of the podcast.
Caesar 2. Yeah.
Yes.
It's the second one, you know. Augustus Caesar.
Ah, the better Caesar.
Shut your whore mouth. I'm all about that Orange Julius.
So for topic for this show and actually going to be the next show, Richard and I were kicking around some ideas and we've got some more in the pipeline, but we really wanted to start doing some in-depth profiles of notable anime creators, directors, animators, manga authors, and
the big names, giants of the industry.
Giants of the industry, which is, you know, why we actually have a list started. But we're going to go ahead. We're going to start this off with a creator that's very near to both of our hearts, Mr. Tomino Yoshiyuki.
Ah, kill them all, Tomino.
Ah, yes.
So let me just segue into our spoiler policy. Most of the shows we're talking about are 30-plus years old. If you're the kind of person who gets offended and angry, you hear a spoiler, the point you'll get in the middle of a panel and rush out because the ending of Zambot 3 got ruined for you. Turn off the podcast now. Go and, I don't know. Do something else. Find a stuffed animal to hug on. Like, you know, get your mom to make you some warm milk.
Yep.
Maybe cry a little bit. It's okay.
Come back to see us in a couple episodes when we're not talking about this specific topic, and we'll spoil something else inadvertently or advertently, whichever it is.
Our policy is if it's a currently airing within the next, say, past year show, we'll try our best to avoid spoilers. If something's so old that it has almost certainly influenced 3 or 4 generations of shows down the line, I'm sorry, like, we're going to talk about the endings when, if they're necessary to the topic at hand.
Yep.
We'll try to throw a spoiler warning at the beginning of the episode. Hey, we talk about the endings here. Move on. That's the best we can do for you.
Yeah, and, you know, depending on the category of spoiler, I think it's safe to say that in a show like this, we're going to talk about spoilers in very general terms, mm-hmm. you know, thing, because we're going to talk about series, but we're not going to go, like, super in-depth.
Yeah. But let's just say Tomino has a very well-known nickname for a reason.
Yes. Yeah, it's very thematic. Mm-hmm. That's the...
You can definitely tell when he's taking his meds.
Yes.
Or when he's off.
Yeah. So we've talked about spoilers, we've talked about our topic, that we're going to start doing some creator profiles. This is kind of the pilot of that. So if you happen to like this episode and everything like that, I'm going to go ahead and get all the internet stuff out of the way. You can download us, you can download our podcast from our website at akibaren.net.
You wouldn't download a car, would you? You wouldn't download a Drew, would you?
Well, if you would, you probably got some real fucking problems.
Oh no, mine's corrupt. Let me just delete this one and start over.
That's always the best way.
Yeah,
it's what my mom tried to do.
Dark.
Yeah. So you can find us online at akibaren.net. You can find us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Akiba Renditions. And if you have any feedback for us, you can certainly use all of those mediums, or you can shoot us a good old-fashioned email at akibaren@gmail.com.
So
let's talk some Tomino.
Okay. Well, you're the stat man. You know all the history and the dates and the
yep.
the places.
I've got my neat bullet-pointed list here that I typed up.
Drew wrote a biography of this man.
A whole this morning. Yeah. Yes. So we're going to end up splitting this up into two parts, just because I think it's going to run really super long if we tried to cram all of this all into one episode.
Yeah, take us over an hour, and I don't think anyone can take us for that long.
No, I barely can take us for that long.
I'm actually planning to just off myself after this episode.
All right, so part two is going to be a solo project. The Drew Sutton project.
Which I believe is some sort of laser.
Yes. All right, so Yoshiyuki Tomino. He was born in on November 5th, 1941, in Odawara City, which is in Kanagawa Prefecture. That's on the west side of Tokyo Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So not very far from Tokyo. What is considered now still pretty much a general Tokyo area compared to the rest of the country. After majoring in film in university, he graduated and started working in Osamu Tezuka's Mushi Production Company in 1964. While he was there, he did storyboarding, screenplays, and the occasional episode direction of a show called Tetsuan Adam, or as many people in the United States and North America know, as Astro Boy.
Mm-hmm.
Astro Boy is famous for being the first serialized television anime to run on Japanese TV, and is pretty much the forerunner of the quote-unquote the modern anime industry.
Mm-hmm.
While he was at Tezuka Pro, he ended up working with a guy by the name of Rintaro, which is pretty notable.
Yeah, we'll get into him probably briefly when we talk about Matsumoto.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, he was, you know, like a broken clock, right, twice a day.
Yep. Very successful. He's a successful director in his own right, even though his films may be... They got a lot of mixed feedback, let's call it that. So he ended up leaving Mushi Pro in 1967, and then worked as a freelancer until he got married in 1971. He was doing a lot of, like, most of his freelance work was in advertising and for commercials. And, you know, it's not really... I didn't really find a clear reason why he left Mushi. You know, maybe it's the fact that, you know, people like Tezuka were fucking slave drivers. But he described working as a freelancer then as financially difficult. In addition, I was so accustomed to desk work at that point, my body had a hard time switching to a job that was more physical. As a result, I went back into animation. It was childish work, but I could make ends meet.
I'd really love to see some of those commercials. I just imagine, like, you know, young boy, like, you know, going to pick a product off the shelf and then, like, you know, getting slapped by, like, an older man. Not even my father ever hit me. Well, you should have bought the right brand of chips, asshole.
Yeah, yeah. You know, trying to think of other, like, famous anime director or people became famous anime directors, what they would direct as commercials or whatever. Like, could you imagine Hideaki Anno trying to you know, do a commercial, I don't know, maybe about a nutritious diet that consists of Yebisu beer and cigarettes.
Yeah. He'd burn the advertising budget up halfway through, and then the rest would just be like a crudely drawn sketch on a napkin, claiming, oh, this is for stylistic reasons, not because I'm bad with money.
Yeah. So, actually, that may be a topic in its own right, like trying to find non-anime work by anime, noted anime people. Yeah,
that could be fun.
It could be fun.
It might work better as a panel. I don't know. It might be more visual.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think a podcast might be a little hard. But anyway, so Tomino would also go on to say about his time. In that sense, I returned to all of this with a very pragmatic frame of mind. But I did things differently getting back into animation. This time, I worked on as many genres as I could. At the time, I was making around half of my income from storyboarding, and I thought that as somebody that is that involved with making animation, I just wanted to increase my level of skill by accepting whatever work came my way. When some of my storyboards were taken up, I could then get involved in directing. Fundamentally, though, I was focused on improving my skill and to deal with all sorts of areas. In hindsight, looking back at those days, I can see it was very important for me that I did all of this. Tomino's doing storyboarding. He wants to get into directing. I think it's very notable because when you think of Tomino, when lots of people think of Tomino, they think of robot shows. If they're not thinking of Gundam specifically, they're thinking about just fucking robot shows.
It is mostly what he did.
It is mostly what he did later in his career, but it's very interesting to see that he has his hands in all of these different genres of shows.
Well,
early on.
Yes, but at this point, he's a freelancer, like doing storyboarding. He's taking whatever work he can get. This isn't creative work for him. This is just, I gotta get paid work.
Yeah.
You'll see once he's actually the lead writer and the lead director, it's mostly robot shows the whole way down.
Yeah, but I think having that exposure into these other genres, I think also gives him some of the story tools that he needs that makes some of his robot shows stand out.
I don't think he can really say that his early work in the industry, like, I mean, it might have affected some of what he did, but that's true of everybody. Like, it's a meat grinder. Like, he's doing this work just to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got to toil away in the process until eventually you get a chance to, like, hey, you know, I've got this idea, somebody listens, and you finally get your shot.
Yeah.
That's just sort of, I think every creator, like we're going to talk about, has had this sort of, like, had to toil away in the animation minds before getting the chance to tell their own stories.
Yeah, all right. I think that's a very good point. So while he's freelancing and doing these storyboards, he's not just working on advertising work, but he's also picking up some independent storyboarding work, working on other anime series. The notable series that he works on during this time are Inekape Taisho, Kyoji no Hoshi, and Dokonjo Gaio. Dokonjo Gaio is kind of a not a robot. It's a monster show, sort of like Kitaro.
Yeah.
And then Inekape Taisho is this family comedy about this dude from the country, and kind of moves towards the big city, and it's a goofy little show. It's very popular amongst people who are over the age of 40, but I hesitate to say that it's like this groundbreaking.
It may have been very popular with people over 40 at the time. I don't think there's anybody now who's, you know, really, like, you know, nostalgic for Inekape Taisho.
Yeah, and maybe that's true too. Like, I've seen it hit, like, all of these best anime lists of, like, the 70s, or best anime lists of, you know, all time, and it's, you know, that tends to populate heavily in the 70s and 80s.
Sure. But I don't think he really, again, that's not much of the Tomino's work. Like, he's involved, but it's tangentially at best.
Yes.
Like.
Yes, yes. Of those three, I'd say Kyoji no Hoshi is the most important as a work, but again, that's such a small piece of his portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of interesting. So as I said, in 1971, he got married, and he decided to stop freelancing, and he went back to work for Mushi Productions. And this is where he gets his first full credit as a screenwriter, or writing a screenplay, for Sasurai no Taiyo, or The Wandering Sun, in 1971. This is based on a manga written by Fujikawa Keisuke and Suzuki Mayumi. And this series is notable not just for his credit, but this is the first time he works with Yasuhiko.
Yeah.
Yasuhiko Yoshikazu, who...
He's notable for being the character designer for all the Gundam series that Tomino works on.
Yep.
As well as... he's a notable character designer in general.
Yeah.
As well as an accomplished manga author.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He has several of his own works that are... have been released commercially and been pretty successful. But the big thing is that he works with Tomino later on Gundam. Mm-hmm. Next year, in 1972, he makes his directorial debut with a show called Umi no Triton. This is based on Tezuka's manga Blue Triton, and this is also with Mushi Production. This show is... I think there's some themes in the show that Tomino can expand upon later.
Well, this is definitely the first instance you start to see of Tomino having some sort of influence.
Yes.
Because the ending is a very Tomino-style ending.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's very much, Tomino's big thematic thing is that man is, man's inhumanity to man, is the real monster. No jokes, but very rarely, and especially in his later works, it's not like, oh no, there's a spooky alien race. It's more like, oh, it turns out they're just humans, and the humans are killing humans.
Mm-hmm.
Adults versus children. That's sort of like, innocence versus, I guess worldly sin. I don't know how to call it, corruption, I suppose. It's very much a binarily split that way, humans versus humans. Mm-hmm. And he tends to lean more towards women and children are pure, and adult men are immoral.
We're the ones that fuck it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wars are our fault, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I could say that, he is not wholly wrong in that, I don't think.
No.
But...
I would tend to agree with him in a lot of ways, but we're not here to discuss his particular politics.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about, thematics, and it's a good... if you want to just go ahead and... Hey, guys, spoiler.
Yeah, spoiler alert, okay. So the end of the series of Umi no Triton... our hero, who is from the Triton tribe, he is going after the Poseidon tribe because he believes that the other members of his tribe have been wiped out by the Poseidons. Therefore, the Poseidons are evil. And he goes through this whole series until we get to the end, and it turns out tables are turned. The Tritons were the ones that kind of started it all with the Poseidons, and There's this shocking realization that, everything I was told before is, probably wrong. And I think we see a lot of that in Gundam, which we'll talk about later.
But. Also, Tomino must really hate Poseidon, because in El Gaim, the main evil empire is the Poseidon Empire.
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. Well, maybe he just hates the seas, claiming a close personal friend of the Nish and his drug running gun smuggling boat.
Oh yeah. Speaking of the Nish, in 1974, Tomino directed one episode of Space Battleship Yamato, where I believe he had some personality conflicts with said Nishizaki Yoshinobu.
Yeah, well, just like everybody else, wasn't hopped up the gills on meth. Shocking that. Well, we all know that the Nish was a driving force in the industry and didn't just spiral into uselessness with Thunder Sub and Space Sailor Odin.
Ah, yes, Odin. Photon Space Sailor Starlight.
we'll cover Nishizaki, I'm sure, in a future episode.
Oh, absolutely. So Umi no Triton is 1972. It airs or broadcasts all within the same year. So sometime between 1973 and 1975, Tomino becomes affiliated with a little animation studio called Nippon Sunrise. And
I know it's hard to think of it back then as a little animation studio, considering it's a juggernaut.
Right, they are that Sunrise.
Yeah. But no, in the late 70s, they were a handful of people, like, barely scraping by.
Right, and what they would do is they would contract with other animation firms, like Toei Animation, Toho Shinsha, handfuls of others, and they would take on a bunch of the production work, as well as the animation work, and sort of work these kind of co-productions with them. So in 1975, Tomino is working for Sunrise, and they get a contract with Tohoku Shinsha, on a little cartoon called Yusha Raiden, or The Brave Raiden.
This is his first foray into the realm of the giant robot.
Right.
Where he will make his niche.
Yep. So Tomino does storyboarding, and he is the chief director for the first half of the writing TV series. The second half of that TV series is directed by Nagahama Tadao.
You may later know from the Nagahama Romance Trilogy, Combatler 5, Volt SV, and...
Combatler V, Volt S5, Daimos.
Daimos.
Yeah.
Toshio Daimos.
Yes.
Sorry, I got my Vs and my Fives mixed up.
I know, right? Crazy that.
Take away my mecha card. I'm one from, I believe, High Crimes and Treason in the Philippines now.
Yes. So all of those shows were co-productions that Sunrise did with Toei Animation.
Fun fact, after this, I guess Nagahama and Tomino have maintained some sort of relation. They'd work together again in the future. Tomino would do some production work for Voltus 5.
Mm-hmm. But this is the first kind of... Like, I imagine that there's some working relationship with them as Tomino's finishing up his work on writing, and he's kind of handing everything over to Nagahama to finish. But it's nice to see that they work together later on different series as well.
I mean, it's just, you see, early on, especially the industry being as small as it was at the time, you'll see these names sort of brush up against each other, like, frequently.
Right. So, in 1977, Nippon Sunrise finally gets into their own original creations game. They're going to start producing some of their own content. Mm-hmm. This is, right now, it's about one show per year. So it's still really small, and it's only TV animation, so it's not super high budget. But Tomino gets the chief directing credits for all of their first TV shows. 1977, he directs the show Muteki Chojin Zambat 3. He's also one of the part of the creating roundtable for the show.
And he definitely makes his presence known. Zambat 3 starts off as your bog standard, like, here's a group of children and a transforming super robot fighting evil. And it starts to get dark real quick. I believe there's an episode where they got the evil killer, the butcher, who straps orphans to him. He's like his robot, so they can't fight back without murdering orphans.
Without murdering orphans, yeah.
And this is the episode, again, I force people to run up and leave out of disgust at panels talking about this. This is where Tomino gets his Kill 'Em All nickname.
Yeah.
Like, no one makes it out of this show alive. Like, it is very dark.
Yeah. And I think if you look at super robot shows of the 1970s, particularly the late 70s, these things are a dime a dozen. Every animation studio is cranking 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of these types of shows out. So it makes sense that...
Because they're highly profitable with the merchandise and the toys.
Right. And also, varying quality. These shows don't necessarily have to be good. They just have to be good enough to get on air. Because certainly we've had many of our discussions about, all of our shitty robot shows, and a lot of them all come from, this 1975 to 1982 window.
Just consider that, sci-fi, even in the U.S., was just exploding at the time.
Yeah.
Worldwide sci-fi was a thing, and in Japan that took the form of, space operas and giant robots.
Yep.
And we'll start to combine the two very soon.
Yeah. So Zambat, makes a splash. It doesn't break rules, but it bends the rules as far as what to expect out of Super Ocean.
The rules are broken by the end of it. The heroes don't, lose in a Super Robot show. I mean, they didn't lose, but they don't win either.
Yeah, okay.
Your main guy is never dead at the end of a Super Robot show until Zambat 3. Well, maybe he dies heroically, whatever, but it's not, a you know, Pyrrhic victory, we're like, yeah, won, but at what cost?
Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. Yeah, that, those are all good points. So the rules are broken, in many respects.
Yeah. And, you know, surprisingly, Zambot's not super popular at this time period.
Yeah. But, it, I mean, it's popular enough that Sunrise also doesn't go bankrupt.
Yeah. They make their money on it. They don't...
Right.
But it's not like, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who isn't, like, the most hardcore, like, robot nerd in Japan who, like, fondly remembers Zambot 3.
Yeah.
Again, because it was so unexpected. It was dark. It was not... It didn't hit the... Japan sort of has their expectations of a show, and it...
Exactly.
It subverted that, and they were like, ugh.
Yeah, oh, I don't know. I don't know about this.
Which kind of leads into why Daitarn 3 is much lighter in tone.
Yeah, so the next year, 1978, Tomino directs Muteki Kojin Invincible Iron Man Daitarn 3, which is a change in tone from Zambot 3.
Yeah, whereas instead of being, you know, piloted by, you know, children and like, you know, all the death and destruction and awfulness, it's, you know, millionaire playboy Banjo Aaron and his, like, you know, two beautiful, like, women assistants and, like, his butler fighting, you know, the evil meganoids from Mars and, you know, with his invincible Superman in Turn 3.
Yeah. It's much more in line with those cultural expectations of what a robot show is supposed to
be. It's definitely much more traditional and, you know, as odd as it is, it's actually a better show, I think, than a Zambot.
Yeah.
Sometimes having the strictures to work in where he, you know, can focus more on the smaller details and the overarching story.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely, it's not a, if you're not deeply into, like, 70s robot shows, I wouldn't seek it out.
Yeah.
But if you like, hey, you know, this, like, late 80s, or this late 70s, early 80s, like, Mecha Explosion, like, that's my jam.
Yeah.
Definitely seek out, well, both Zambot and Daitarn.
Right.
Daitarn is, like, very well done. There's nothing like super surprising. Oh no, the Meganoids! Turns out they're created by Banjo's father. Oh my god!
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, it doesn't end with, like, you know, universe restarts or like space babies or anything crazy. Like, for Tomino standards, this is really toned down.
Yeah. So at this time, Sunrise is still doing those co-productions. So I guess, you know, one or two of their original series flopping wouldn't necessarily doom the company.
No.
But actually,
and Daitarn did very well for them.
Yeah, I was gonna ask. Like, did Daitarn do well? It sounds like it did because it hit more on those notes that people were expecting. So it sounds like it did better in the money ratings department.
Mm-hmm. But you know, as these shows go on, there's more and more of a I don't want to say an underground, but they're not underground, but like just a market that isn't there necessarily in the first watch. Like, the sci-fi fans are starting to take more notice of the cartoons.
Yes.
Like, the guys who are basically spending their time in sci-fi novels and, you know, war games and things like that are starting to pay more attention to the cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
Let's, you know, segue into our next show, the show, the one...
Yeah, the show that everybody, you know, comes for when you hear Tomino's name.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1979, Tomino is the, you know... chief director of a little TV series, Mobile Suit Gundam.
Yeah. Together with a couple friends of his, you know, Yoshikazu Yasuhiko.
Yep.
And Okuwara Kunio.
Yep. So Okuwara does all the mechanical designs.
Yasuhiko
does all the character designs.
And, you know, Tomino writes the story.
Yeah. So Tomino's story of Gundam, you know, has some of those same themes that go back to, you know, Triton, where instead of having, you know, aliens invade the Earth and there's robots that fight, it's, you know, well, it's humans that are living in space versus humans that live on Earth. And
he's telling a political story. Basically, it's a somewhat of a callback, you know, with the themes to World War II.
Yep.
This time Japan's on the Allies side. But, you know, it's very much a straightforward civil war. Like, you know, the brother is your enemy. Like, you know, humans fighting humans and general, like, war atrocity.
Yeah.
It's a very, like, political, like, it's very charged. Like,
right.
You can definitely tell, like, from a guy who grew up in post-war, like, Japan, like, there's definitely some of that, like, coloring the Gundam. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a very anti-war, like, giant robot show.
Yes.
But the whole setting is, of course, that, like, no longer are these super weapons of, like, you know, superheroes and aren't invincible Supermen. They're tanks. They're tanks with legs, or, like, fighter jets. They're...
Right.
That's...
It's
the thematic shift in Japan from, like, look at my, you know, oh my god, Tetsujin 28, he's the guardian savior of humanity, to, okay, well, hey, look, it's the P-44 Mustang or whatever.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Very much like, it's just a tool of war, it's a tank, it's a plane, it's a ship.
Right. It you know, it's an inanimate object, it takes on whatever personality of the person controlling it.
Well,
right?
Not
personality
even,
ambition.
No, don't even, no, giving it a personality or an ambition is, that's too, it's not, the star of the show is not necessarily the suit, it is the guy piloting the suit.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, I
follow now, yeah.
You don't see it as much in this particular, because the Gundam is, you know, it's, so I mean, it bucks the tropes, but the Gundam's still nearly indestructible, it is the hero suit for the entire show.
Yeah.
But, like, Char isn't any less of a threat in a Zaku, or when he's, you know, oh, he's got his Zagok, or when he's in a Gelgoog.
Yeah.
He's a threat every time.
Yep.
And no matter what suit he's in, he's, like, it doesn't matter, you just know, hey, there's Char, like... You know.
Yeah.
And it gets much better. They hammer that point home a lot more in later Gundam series. But, like, it really sort of, you know, it, like, by the end of the series, the Gundam is outclassed, and it's all entirely up to pilot skill.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, again, definitely so much of the, like, the military tactics make more... Like, the Gundam is not the turning force of the war. Like, it's present in a couple major battles, but, like, we focus on this one unit in the entire show.
Yeah.
But there's other, like, military maneuvers and things. They're not the lone savior of the, you know, the Earth. Like, there's an entire army fighting battles we don't see.
Yeah.
That, like, you know... It's definitely much more, like... Again, it fits much better in the 80s than it does in the 70s. It's a very...
Yeah.
So at the time, Japan didn't give a shit. They didn't like this show.
Yeah,
they're
which
like,
is...
What is this horse crap?
Right. Oh, which is weird because, you know, you think about Gundam now as this, you know, fucking juggernaut of, like, all the merch.
Uh-huh.
And...
So Tomino went on the limb and got his ass canceled.
Yeah. Yeah. So the series was cut back from, like, 49 or 50 episodes, like, 43.
Yeah.
Well,
it was cut down initially, like, to 39, and then, like, he was able to get, like, 4 episodes to...
Oh, yeah. He bargained for some extra time.
Like, it was cut off, like, immediately. He's like, look, let me just wrap this up.
Yeah.
And they gave it to him, so he was able to, you know, get to 43 episodes.
Yep. Yeah. So he was able to finish the story out.
Oh, by the way, if you guys are looking at your DVD sets, you say, I only see 42. It's because in America, you got robbed. They took away Doan's Island.
Which is the best Gundam episode.
You know, do not buy the Gundam Blu-rays, all right? They cut out the best episode. I want my money back, Sunrise. Bandai. Or I want my Doan's Island. Either way. I'll throw that in there.
I'm sure they're going to get right on that. Yeah. You know, send you that episode.
Yeah, by the way, I was legitimately mad when I found that out. Like, I bought the thing, and I'm like, I want to go throw the Blu-ray, and I'm like, what the shit? I can't get terrible, like, the worst quality of any fucking anime, like, episode in, like, beautiful Blu-ray. Still fucking angry. Pardon the language.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have a language disclaimer on all of our episodes, so,
well,
you know.
We should.
Yeah. So, Gundam, you know, Gundam is this commercial failure, but like you were saying, like, people who were spending times in, you know, reading sci-fi novels and things like that, they're starting to notice, some of the shows that are coming on.
Yeah.
And
this one sort of catches a, like, huh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Also, going in this favor, there's sort of a shift in merchandising from the simple, like, expensive, like, Chogokin, like, you know, metal toys.
Yeah.
To plastic model kits. And Gundam is sort of the first big push for these kits.
Right.
And Bandai, you know, the toy company, you know, They're inexpensive. They put them out there. They're cheap. They're one color. There's no, like, you snap them together and they're like a statue.
Right.
But they're the biggest thing is that they're cheap and they're customizable.
Yep.
And there's a burgeoning, like, you know, model kit scene. People may not necessarily have cared. You know, they're model tanks, model planes. They're like, huh, model robot. I'll give it a try.
Yep.
And a lot of people started, you know, hey, what is this show? Well, let me see if I can find a rerun of it. And they, you know, picked it up that way. The sci-fi people heard about the show.
Yep.
Like, huh, you know, I really like... Even people were, like, watching Star Blazers or any of that other space opera stuff. Like, hold on, there's a like, a politically charged, you know, head, like, more hard sci-fi, like, a cartoon show? Well, let's check out the robot thing.
Yeah.
So a lot of those fans are starting to tune in and seek out the repeats.
Yep.
And oddly enough, like, as, you know, because at this point in time in Japan, then, you know, they'd run the content in various odd hours and just repeat. The ratings started going up.
Yeah. So the ratings are going up. Some of these notable people that are tuning into this are Kawamori Shoji, who went on to do Macross in 1982.
Yeah. As well as other many of, like, more tragedies against anime. Earthgirl Arjuna.
Yeah.
Aquarian Evil. Macross Delta.
So indirectly, Tomino is partially responsible for some of these terrible pieces of shit.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of two bad influences of Karamori's life.
I think at this time too, Ano Hideaki from Evangelion is also catching this, and you know, I think he already has aspirations to do art of some sort as a profession, but without a Gundam, he's less interested in mechanical work, mechanical like mecha design stuff, and he ends up not working on shows like definitely Char's Counterattack. I know he's on there, but I think he's also got some very minor work in Zeta Gundam.
Maybe. I'm not familiar with any work he did on that one specifically.
Yeah,
but again, it went from this kind of failed like experimental show that just sort of the best way to liken it is an American fan to the original Star Trek.
Yeah,
and canceled before its time, made a huge pile of fans and repeats and reruns. And,
yep, syndication and all that, and then you know becomes this you know mass market sci-fi juggernaut that's you know.
Yeah, but so after Gundam, man, before we get into the big resurgence where Gundam sort of explodes back onto the scene,
right? Because Gundam ends in 1980, and it's 1981 when Ideon starts.
Yeah, so it goes back to the drawing board. He's like, "All right, you know, my experimental idea didn't work too well. I'm sad now. Let's just do some more traditional bullshit like space aliens invading." So you get Ideon, you know.
Yep, the space runaway, or Kyojin Ideon.
Yeah, legendary giant god Ideon. So, you know, there's human colonists on the planet Solo, and they're excavating a ship that they found with these you know, Ide machines, and the Buff Clan comes out of nowhere, and they're like, oh, we've been searching for this for years, give it up to us. And they're like, no, you guys are evil space aliens.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm oversimplifying, because there's a lot of Ideon, and it's not... It's good if you... So, I'll recommend if you watch Ideon, watch the compilation movies. It really takes a lot of the fluff out. But Ideon is like very much like Tomino's pissed off, snarky, fuck you, like here's your aliens versus humanity garbage. And it ends abruptly because it got canceled. Because, again, people didn't... You could, fuck you, here's your shit is not necessarily the best way to... To recover from, like, weird experimental, like... and that's probably me projecting a bit onto it. But... Ideon's not great.
But at the same time...
And again, another example of Kill 'Em All Tomino. Where he's mad, he's not happy with, like, the way things are going. The show ends very... again, well, it's canceled. Within an episode, very much, like... Ideon itself, like, it becomes, you know, self-aware, and it decides that, like, humanity's had its chance... and it just and it basically ends both it ends the conflict entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Both sides are all completely eliminated,
right?
And it restarts time, and like basically it goes through a cycle to the end where like hey we're back on Earth again, the humanity's got another like one last shot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the ending.
So
it's very much a feeling of Tomino's of like
frustration.
Yeah, you definitely that's the central theme of the show is just. Like, I tried to do something different, mm-hmm. like, but like the cycle just starts again.
One step forward, two steps back, and then eventually something's going to give.
Yeah.
So it's at this time in 1981. Mm-hmm. You know, Gundam's still on reruns. Ideon doesn't hit the notes that Tomino wants it to hit, and you know, Bandai, who's a at this time they're a big sponsor of Sunrise's work because of all the merchandising tie-ins, mm-hmm. And these plastic model kits that Richard was talking about earlier, they're starting to sell. Mm-hmm. Like there's an interest in Gundam again.
Yeah, to the point where I think at this point they're starting to MSV, MSVR, like lines of model kits based on variants from if we kit bash some stuff together, we can sell a different like version of the Zaku.
Right, and that's an extra 900 yen we didn't have before.
Yeah. Like they're starting to, you know, again, money's really starting to pour in from this thing.
Right. So it's at this time that Sunrise decides that they can get into the feature film game, mm-hmm. And Tomino heads up the project to take Mobile Suit Gundam onto the big, onto the big screen.
Yeah.
And in 1981, we get the first two Gundam compilation movies,
which are mostly cobbled together from existing footage with certain things cleaned up here and there.
Yeah.
And
particularly, like, the first movie is probably, like, the shittiest looking because it's the most, or it's the least touched, but has the most, like, original TV footage.
So also, like, just, this isn't just a Tomino's chance to, oh, good, I get to put my stuff back up there on the screen. He gets to scrub the stink of, like, the corporate, like, touch out of his vision.
Yes.
There were certain things put, extra robots, the stupid mobile armor.
Right, because when your sponsor is a toy company,
yeah.
They want as many things in that show that they can sell fucking toys of.
But, with this theatrical release and the fact that, basically they're able to sell toys on things that aren't even in the show.
Yeah.
Like, it's less, they're like, hey, great, just give us, put Gundam out there in the spotlight more. We want to make more money on the toys we have. So he's able to cut a lot of the sillier parts out and get a much more, darker thematic. Like, again, it's that political story he wanted to tell. He can cut all the fluff out, all the parts, hell, we need to have, a comic relief episode, we need to have this episode, we need to hit all the high points and low points. He's able to tell the story he wants to tell.
Yes. And, I've got an interview here I'll put in the show notes where Tomino's talking about that process of distilling the TV series into the compilation movies. And he goes on to say that, you can see a much closer vision of what I was trying to accomplish with Gundam mm-hmm. through these compilation movies than necessarily from watching the TV show. Movie 3 is released in 1982, which is the final compilation, or the final piece of the compilation films. It's the one that has the most new animation in it.
Yeah.
So there's things from the TV series are just reanimated for the theatrical screen, and that theatrical budget.
Yeah. Gotta clean out that that old gun tank. Gotta get all the G-Armor episodes out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a significant amount of cuts of the TV series that they just get rid of.
Yeah. Which necessitates a lot of reanimation.
Yep.
This is a massive commercial success.
Yes. This is where Gundam
becomes Star Wars.
Really, yeah. Gundam stands on its own now. Mm-hmm. Now it's not like, oh, get this shit off my TV. I will pay you money to go watch this. It's gone from we can't sell these, we can't sell these little metal toys to, oh my god, I can't wait till all these model kits come out.
Yeah.
And people are people start clamoring. They're like, "I want more Gundam now."
Yeah, I mean, just the very industries launched from this in Japan. Like, there's print media dedicated to Hobby Japan.
Right.
New Type magazine.
Mm-hmm.
shit catches fire.
Yep. It it catches fire. It's the way Gundam changes robot shows starts catching on itself. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I mean, this is the turning point, of the, what separates the 80s robot revolution from, that late 70s super robot, it's definitely a much, this is why you get, the Super Mech Fortress Macross, this is why you get Armored Trooper Votoms, this is why you get Dugram. This is why you get, like...
Eventually you get things like Lasner.
I'm trying to work my way down the line here.
Oh. I know, I'm jumping ahead a couple of years, but...
Either way, like, the point is you get these kind of shows. This is why you get Draganar.
Yeah.
So during this time period, he's not just doing, the clips and the re-edits for Gundam. He's got a little side project he's working on, another TV series. You gotta keep those churning out as well.
Yep.
And you can definitely tell he's much happier, because he's got his Gundam project.
And it's successful. Yeah, well, right? You know, he has something close to his vision, and it's successful.
Yeah, but we don't know it's successful yet.
You're right.
Yeah, so... But he's getting to do his Gundam thing, so, you know... During this time period, okay, great. I get to, you know... He's working on Combat Mecha Zabungle.
Mm-hmm.
Which is definitely, you can tell from the lighthearted nature of the show. It's definitely a happy Tomino. And this is a great show. It gets overlooked just due to the time period where... Like, again, Gundam!
Yeah, it's 1982. There's the massive Gundam specter looming over it. But there's also just a lot of other stuff in the robot catalog at the time.
Yeah. Well, not as much. Like, 82 is... Things are starting to get off the ground, but, like, it's not as oversaturated as, say, like, 85 is going to be.
Yes. Yes. Agreed.
And especially as, like, hey, this is from Yoshiyuki Tomino and Sunrise, you know, and Gundam's starting to, you know, get the first movie, I think, is coming out around this time, or has just come out, second movie, as, like, the first couple episodes of this are coming out. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's definitely starting to get noticed.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing, I mean, Zabungle's got a very interesting story to it, It's all about questioning rules and, like...
Right.
You can definitely tell it's a bit of vindication from Tomino.
Because it has a little bit of a dark... There's, like, a dark premise. The thing with, what was it? You can break a law and you have, like, 3 days to...
Yeah.
But,
see, if you get away with it for 3 days, like, then, you know, that's it. You're fine.
Right.
So you've got 3 days to, like, redress somebody break, you know, for... If somebody does something, you've got 3 days to get your revenge. Otherwise, it's, you know, the law says that they're untouchable.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, basically... The whole show, the whole premise of the show is, like, that law is stupid. Like, I'm going to break that law. And he's like, I'm going to continue to hold my grudge after 3 days on the guy who killed his parents.
Right, yeah.
But the whole point is to challenge the authority, to challenge the boundaries of... It's pretty much somebody being like, I was right to do Gundam, you assholes.
Yeah.
It's very, like, if Avion is like, well, you guys were wrong for not liking my show. This is, I was right.
Yeah. Aha. You know, I've never thought of Zabungle like that.
Yeah.
Like, in the way you just described it as, like, this meta, like, all of Tomino's work. Yeah. No, that's an awesome point.
Yeah. So, I think this is the last time you get a... Because, again, this is... After this, because Gundam catches on, Tomino never has to make another show. Like, so he gets to make the shows he wants. He doesn't have to make a show.
Oh, right.
So,
this
isn't that, like, Tomino has to make a show every year.
Yeah.
It may not be his vision, but he has to make something.
Yes. Yeah.
This is the last time that he has to make something.
Right. Now it's Tomino wants to do something.
Yeah, Tomino gets to make what he wants.
Yeah, let's let him do it, yeah.
So after this, I think the next show that he does is Dunbun.
Yeah. Yeah, Dunbun comes in 1983.
Mm-hmm. And Dunbun is definitely way... It's much more like Gundam was. It's not at all like Gundam. It's very fantasy-based, but...
Right. There's robots.
Well, yeah.
But it's...
Aura battlers. You know, yeah. Bug... monsters that are hollowed out and have controls because
I don't know because it's fucking 80s. Really.
H.R. Geiger horror shit.
Right. I've always described Dunbine as, you know, the perfect mix of, you know, Tomino and Tolkien, like high fantasy meets a robot show. Yeah,
but he basically wanted to do like Tomino his so imagine you're a famous artist and, like, you know, some people work in oil, some people work in acrylic. Tomino works in robot.
Yes, yes.
So he's telling his story, and, like, the medium is robot.
Yes.
But he wants to tell his fantasy story, but at the same time, it's connected to the modern world.
Yeah.
Like, there's the parallel worlds, there's Earth, and there's Bistonwell.
Yep.
But it's very much a coming-of-age story. It's like a civil war sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's a fantasy, like...
A lot of things that, you know, most people with Tomino are familiar with. Like, similar themes to some of his other shows and everything like that. It's just, the setting is, like, if you know Tomino, it was only Gundam.
Yeah.
Or even Edeon, or, you know, like, the space SF, type show. It's a little weird to be like, yeah, here's this giant bug robot and all of these horses and fairies.
Yeah. There's definitely a bit of, you know, call this 2 minutes fairy period.
Yes.
Between this and El Game, there's fairies.
Right.
Here there be fairies.
Here there be fairies.
Yeah.
So Blazed in Wild, since you bring it up, is to me is like another one of Tomino's big strong suits is that he can make this world, this setting. Like he's really good at kind of world building, like these small blocks at a time, but he puts enough hooks into all of these small blocks that you're like, oh, I wonder what else is going on, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about like the Gundam being a small piece of this gigantic war.
Yeah.
You know, Beast and Well is like the core of Dunbine is this small piece of this gigantic world.
Mm-hmm.
It when it hits those notes,
yeah.
And you have that world, it's built in for trying to get sequels, trying to get more out of it. Now, with Gundam, some of those sequels ain't half bad.
Yeah.
With Dunbine, all of it is shit.
Except for the OVAs, which got you into the fansub game.
No, they got me out of the fucking fansub game.
Yeah, so Dunbine, like, it goes to these great lengths to set up this great world. A couple of times Tomino chose to go back, you can definitely tell he's disinterested.
Yeah.
And he makes just some, I gotta do some Dunbine shit. And, like, it's not good. We'll talk about that next episode.
Yeah, because a lot of the Dunbine sequels and everything like that are all going to come up in how we're going to split into part two.
So speaking of, we got one last show to really speak of here. And I hate to bring this back up to my point earlier about it, like, he no longer has to make a show.
Yeah.
This one feels like Tomino feels like he has to make a show. It's good, but it's not great. And you can tell that the people involved in it are looking ahead to the next show.
Mm-hmm.
This is Heavy Metal El Gaim.
Yep. From 1984.
Yeah, till 1985. This leads directly into Zeta Gundam. And it's his first collaboration with Moro Nagano.
Yep. Who would later become very famous for writing five-star stories for fucking ever.
Yeah, I believe it's still going on.
Yes, it is.
But, yeah, the mecha designs are fantastic in this show. But it's a pretty straightforward. It's set, you know, in space and on a faraway planet.
Where there are fairies.
Yeah, there are fairies. And there are, you know, heavy metal giant robots where, you know, Prince Dabumairo has to stop the Poseidal Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good show. It's just, there's nothing exciting, nothing thematically new. It's, biggest crime that it has is that it's kind of dull, with the exception of the mecha designs are fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, Nagano, like, it's his first entrance onto the mainstream scene,
mm-hmm.
and he goes nuts. Like, everything he makes in this looks fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, I've always been a big fan of his mecha design work.
Yeah. Like, he'll go on and he'll do a lot of the, a couple of different suit designs for Zeta Gundam, most notably the Hyakushiki.
Mm-hmm.
But he did a couple of the other, Titans designs.
Yeah.
And a lot of the weirder stuff was him.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, it's just his big foot in the door. But you can definitely tell, like, all the real creative juice that, like, you know, Tomino's got is going into Zeta Gundam at this point.
Yeah.
Like, he's clearly started work on that before, and...
Yeah, well, and again, you know, people have been looking... ever since 1982, you know, people are wanting more Gundam, so...
Well...
Certainly he didn't, like, sit down and write it over a weekend.
No.
You know, it's something that he's been kicking around for, a while at this point.
Yeah, he had this idea in his head for this show, probably, you know, planned out well in advance, like, hey, we're going to do this eventually, like, it's Sunrise, you know, got to have a show
right.
out.
Right.
But
at the same time, he's chief director on El Gaim.
Yeah.
So his attention is naturally going to be distracted from it. And,
yeah. And, you know, I highly recommend you guys watch El Gaim. It's good. It's never going to be number one on your playlist.
Yeah.
It's just, if you're looking, hey, man, I want some more of that mid-80s, like, robot show. Y'all got any more of that?
Right.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. And I'll
watch that. Watch Dragonair. Dragonair's the best Gundam show not to be called Gundam.
I'll admit that El Gaim I've started like two or three times and have never been able to get through. It suffers a little bit of kind of meandering. Like you said, its worst crime is that it's kind of dull sometimes, but it's overall...
It's also one of those shows you can pick up in the middle. Like,
yeah,
I started watching the first 10 episodes and then like I lost interest after that. I just come back in and pick up episode 12 or whatever. And
about wherever you think you left off. And
yeah. mean, once you know the basics, it doesn't really matter. Like, you might have some, what happened here? Who's that guy? Whatever.
Yeah. So,
but yeah, that's the journey of the ups and downs. You really, like, again, it's funny. Like, there's a tale of two parts here. Like, it's Tomino getting his foot in the door so he gets a chance to tell his stories. And then Tomino getting a chance to tell his stories and then finding, like, at first they're not accepted. And then, like, you can definitely see in the shows around it, like, his feelings. Like, he's a very expressive, like, director.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much of himself in each show that, like, you can tell the Yoshiyuki Tomino story by just watching the shows.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can see how things are going in his life. Again, they cycle up and down. I think after this, where the real cycle of, you know, happy Tomino, sad Tomino, kill them all. Happy, kill them all. Happy, kill them all.
Yeah.
Like, it starts to peter out after this. I don't think there's any more kill them alls after...
I think, again, not trying to give away too many spoilers, I think character death is still something that's very frequent in his shows.
Well,
but
that's because he has a more...
It's targeted. Yeah. It's, you know, like,
it's not like a, and everyone dies, fuck it. Like,
yeah, it's not...
It's very much like, for a maximum dramatic effect, this character
died. Right, yeah, there's a storyline reason for things happening.
It's one thing, you know, telling a story and one thing to just, okay, and then everything ends by exploding.
Yeah. All right, well, so we're coming up on an hour. We're going to end it here for part one of our Yoshiyuki Tomino profile. We'll be picking up in the next episode, episode 5, will be part two of this. And we're going to go ahead and start with 1985's Zeta Gundam.
Yeah.
You know, the sequel that everybody fucking clamors for. And we'll go ahead and we'll finish out.
Will it possibly live up to the original?
Will it?
Yes!
So, thanks everybody for listening. Hope you're looking forward to the next episode. And we'll try and have it out, you know,
hit
super quick.
Hit us up on the tweet machines or the Facebook.
Yeah, hit us up at Akiba Ren, or Akiba Renditions on Twitter or Facebook. Yeah. Akiba Ren at Gmail for the email box. And
contact all your local anime cons, demand they bring us in as a guest. Contact every other podcast you know, have them bring us on as a guest. You know what I mean? Just throw money at us. Do we have a PayPal? Let's get that set up.
I can
Patreon,
get
a... whatever. Like, send us a check. You know, money order payable. Like,
payable to cash.
Yeah, payable to cash.
All right. Hope everybody enjoyed it, and looking forward to talking to you again. All right. Later. もう帰ることない宇宙の星よさらばさらばもう会えはしないけれど涙はいらない僕らには母がいる父がいる平和で豊かな地球Okay.